and welcome to episode 83 of SMARTS, which, as you know, stands for Savitar's Malevolent Acolytes Require Teamworking Strategies.
Teamworking strategies.
I almost had that smoothly.
Almost.
What do you think? You like it?
I like it.
Yes. Excellent. Me and Mum put it together. Or I should say Mum and I. To be grammatically correct. Yes.
I and mum.
Yes. That, although correct, does sound a little weird. Anyway, I am Julia Guglia of Internet Fame Dash Podcaster, and with me, as always, is my co-host slash husband slash love of my life, Trevor, a.k.a. Rutiger Q Podcaster.
Hello.
What do we have for news today?
We have news.
Well, excellent.
There's new news on the internet.
The news is that there's news. Yes. And what is that news?
Well, there's some casting.
PS news.
There's some casting news.
Okay.
So,
I saw you read something and I was excited to hear it. And you're like, I'm saving it for the show.
The role of T'Challa's mother in the upcoming Black Panther movie has been cast.
Yeah.
And the role will be played by Angela Bassett.
Oh, snap. I love it. Yes. That's so awesome. I can't wait. Oh my gosh.
So we have, this movie is a who's who of old guard and up and coming African American talent. Mm-hmm. Although I think Chadwick Boseman is British, isn't he? Not American? Because I think he's British. I don't think he's American.
I can't remember. I thought he was British.
So, because you've got everyone from Denai Gurira, is that how she pronounced her name? From The Walking Dead, right? Michonne from The Walking Dead to Michael B. Jordan from Creed to Angela Bassett to Chadwick Boseman himself to, I'm probably forgetting even more people. But it's got a pretty amazing cast shaping up so far.
That is exciting.
In other casting news, James Remar, who is a character actor that you would probably recognize. He's been in a bunch of stuff. He's been in a bunch of cop shows. He did the voice of Hawkman on Justice League Unlimited, but he was also the one thing that I saw him in recently with you, and this is such a minor thing, but do you remember the Battlestar Galactica episodes where they had to go down onto Cobalt to take the arrow of Apollo and find the tomb that they could put it in?
Yeah,
and
I remember.
God, what was his name? The guy. This is getting several levels deep. Tom Zarek was plotting. Tom Zarek had like his right hand man was plotting to kill Lee so that he could.
Yes, yes.
James Remar was the
right hand man.
Because you know that actor, you've seen him in a bunch of stuff. So that's James Remar. He was cast in a recurring role in Gotham.
Uh-huh.
He's going to be playing Jim Gordon's uncle, Frank Gordon.
Oh wow!
Who's going to appear on the show and I think he's gotten himself mixed up in some bad stuff. Like he's more on the wrong side of the tracks, and Jim's going to try to help him, but get pulled into some stuff. That's the impression I get from the casting.
Interesting. Wow. Cool.
And then lastly, we have our first potential bit of Star Trek Discovery casting news. God, I'm terrible with names today. Nicholas Meyer, the writer director of, Wrath of Khan and Undiscovered Country, who's also on the writing team for Star Trek Discovery, just mentioned offhand, probably accidentally, Paramount's lawyers probably descended on him like locusts five minutes after this. I can just picture them all sitting around in like whatever the lawyer equivalent of a firehouse is. And then as soon as he mentions a name on a podcast, the alarm goes off and they all put their blazers on and slide down a lawyer pole to get to the lawyer mobile and ride away to the podcast studio.
lawyer pole.
But he mentioned on this podcast that Michelle Yeoh she was the female co-lead of the James Bond movie Tomorrow Never Dies. She was also one of the leads in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yes.
And Memories of a Geisha. I think was she in Memories of a Geisha too?
Memoirs of a Geisha.
That too.
yes, she was. She
is going to have a is going to be one of the stars of Star Trek Discovery.
Oh wow!
It's possible he misspoke. It's possible he was kidding, I guess, whatever, but this has been seized on as the first casting news. So given that we knew that the lead of the show was going to be female, people immediately assumed that she's going to be the star of the show.
Okay.
But then further news has come out that she's playing a captain, and we know that the star of the show is not going to be a captain, but is going to be like a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander or something. So now it appears that Michelle Yeoh will have a role on the show, but she will be the captain of another ship, not the Discovery. She won't be on the main Discovery crew. She'll be the captain of a different, I guess, a different Starfleet ship or something.
Huh,
like
okay.
So it does seem pretty certain that she's going to be on the show. This is the first bit of casting news, but she's not. It seems less likely that she's going to be the lead, but she will have a role on the show. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good for the first bit of casting.
Yeah.
I think the only thing ever, because I never saw Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, so I think the only thing I've seen her in is Tomorrow Never Dies, which was okay, but it's not probably not the acting showcase for her that you would
I don't think that was the acting showcase for anybody on that film.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Terry Hatcher was pretty good in it.
Yeah.
She didn't last very long in that movie, but she was pretty good. Yeah, so that's it for news this week. Just a little bit of casting news. Pretty slow week because of Thanksgiving.
Exciting. I was trying to get information about the casting news you read, and nope, you wouldn't crack. You were an unbreakable safe. Okay, well, that was very exciting. Okay, so what are we doing? Comic of the week?
Exactly.
Excellent. Okay, this week my comic of the week is Titans number 5.
I thought you would pick that.
Did you? Yeah, it made me cry. It did. But... well, it's a simple story, basically, picking up where we left off last time. Abra Kadabra, or whatever his Batman name is, has the entire team Titans in precarious situations, and only Wally West can stop them. And so, I mean, stop them from being hurt and or killed and or mutilated. So, long story super short. He has 5 seconds to get to all of these places across the country or globe. Did he disperse them across the globe or just the country? Trevor's shaking his head. Very useful in an audio format. Anyhow, so the entire issue only takes place in about 6 seconds, but Wally has to run faster than he's ever had to run before, with the exception of... Trevor's making a face, with the exception of the situation that got him into.
Thinking of all the times he had to run faster than that before.
Yeah, there's always a time I have to run faster than I've ever run before. Yes, that's kind of what a speedster's biggest challenge is, to outrun himself. Ghost speedster? Is that a story arc name? Anyway, but he successfully runs as fast as he needs to save everybody. But the cost of that is that if he runs at a certain speed, he runs right into the Speed Force and goes back into the ether from whence he came. And he does that. He sacrifices himself, and the last person that he sees before he goes back into the Speed Force is Linda, who he loves and who he would tell that... like, he there's this beautiful panel at the end where he's thinking his thoughts of, like, I want to tell her that she means everything to me. I want her to pull me out of the Speed Force again. I want her to know that it's not her fault. I want her to know all these things, but I don't want to put all that on her in this final moment. So all he says is, take my hand, and she reaches for it, and he disappears. Oh, that was such a just chest-gripping moment. Oh, it was wonderful. Anyway, the art on top of that was gorgeous, and that's why it's my comic.
Even if he'd said what he wanted to say to her, it wouldn't have helped his present situation, because... it's their connection that allows him to return from the Speed Force. So the fact that he remembers her, now, even if he told her all the things that they'd shared, if she doesn't have those same feelings for him and that same connection to him, it wouldn't do him any good.
Exactly.
It's like in the the Rebirth, the DC Rebirth special, he had all his memories of Barry, but it was only at the very last second, when Barry remembered who he was,
that
he was able to pull him back from where he was about to disappear.
But we get the impression that some indelible mark has been left on her beyond, of course, the trauma of, you know, losing him.
Well, you got that impression. Again,
did she remember
it
something?
It could be read either way, because she's met him 4 or 5 times now, and he has told her that he remembers them having some connection that she doesn't. So it's clear that she understands what she means to him, and, you know, she doesn't want to see this superhero die either. So she has a certain vested interest in it. But I'm not sure if we're supposed to read into it that she's starting to remember him. It wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility, given other stuff we're seeing happen across the.
Yeah.
The Rebirth line, people seem to be remembering some things that they shouldn't. But if she started to remember him, though, we'd be kind of worried that Mr. Oz would swoop
Plucker.
In and throw her in prison beside Tim Drake, I guess.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's why it's my comic of the week. How about you, honey? What was your comic of the week?
Going a little bit off the beaten path here, I'm going to say my comic of the week was Cave Carson Has a Cybernetic Eye.
Really?
Cave Carson Has a Cybernetic Eye number 2.
That was enjoyable.
Which
was
is from DC's Young Animal line, curated by Gerard Way, we've talked about before. I can't remember the name of the... This is me being terrible, but I can't... This is a lot of new indie blood coming in and writing these books, and I don't remember all their names yet, but he co-writes this book. And the art is by Michael Avon Aiming, who did... The critically acclaimed Powers series with Brian Michael Bendis.
I read that.
He was the artist on all of that stuff.
This
series was a lot of fun. It's an obscure sort of adventure hero character from DC's past, back when, in addition to, well, I guess they still kind of have it as evidenced by this book, but time was that the majority of DC's line wasn't, well, it wasn't just superheroes like it is these days, although they have other stuff. But these days, it's like 99% superheroes. Time was you'd have space heroes like Adam Strange and Space Ranger and Space Cabbie and the Omega Man, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And you'd have Viking Prince, you know, you'd have historical stuff, and you'd have Enemy Ace and Sergeant Rock with war dramas, and you'd have romance comics, and you'd have stuff like Cave Carson, which were more of like a... I guess Indiana Jones style archaeology adventure, stuff like that, like hidden realms beneath the earth. And then you'd have sword and sorcery books like Warlord. So the characters like this exist in DC's history, but a lot of people these days don't remember them. So this is taking that character, extrapolating this sort of depressing life he's had since the last time he went on his underground adventures in his vehicle, the Mighty Mole. Mm-hmm. And it posits a life for him where he married the queen of this underground civilization and had a daughter, but then she died, and so he's raising his daughter, you know, back in the regular human world. But this company that he's working for is sort of a low-level flunky, seems to be having some sort of plan in place that involves something to do with the old civilization that uh-huh. his wife was the monarch of. A warrior from that civilization approaches him in his home and says things that don't make any sense to him, but then transforms into this monster. In this issue, he steals the Mighty Mole with the help of his old friend Wild Dog, who people might know from the Arrow TV series these days. And the men in black that are pursuing him after their car crashes, they sort of merge together into another one of these weird monsters.
Yeah, that was crazy. So
there's some sort of conspiracy happening here that we don't fully understand yet, but it's a lot of fun. It takes a classic spelunking adventure hero and transforms it into a sort of a conspiracy thriller, mm-hmm. I suppose, but still with a lot of crazy sci-fi elements like the Mighty Mole. I also enjoyed the little couple page sequence where we just see Wild Dog involved in a just random crime lord hostage situation. Like he's out there every night, and then Cave comes in with the Mighty Mole and solves a problem for him, and he gets recruited to help him. It's just this street level, ultra, ultra hardcore vigilante, super violent, is now going to have to team up with this spelunking family man adventure hero and figure out this mystery. So it's an interesting pairing. I don't know if those characters ever had any connection before. I mean, they've both been around for a very long time, but Cave Carson goes back to probably the 50s or 60s, and Wild Dog was created, I think, in the 80s. So if they met in some obscure story in like DC Presents in 1987 or something, I wouldn't necessarily know it, but I wonder if this is just retconning some friendship between these characters that was established after the last time we saw them, you know. But anyway, it's a lot of fun. And this whole line, you know, with Doom Patrol, Cave Carson, Shade, and Mother Panic, they've all been great. They're sort of a higher level, at a higher reading level, mm-hmm. one could say, than the other DC stuff. Like, you really have to, with the possible exception of maybe, say, Deathstroke, mm-hmm. in that you really have to pay attention because things are jumping around and things are implied but not necessarily stated outright, and characters come and go, and motivations are not always stated super clearly, and there's a large cast of characters that you might not be immediately familiar with, so you really have to pay attention.
Yep.
Unlike picking up, you know, the next issue of Superman, where, you know, they're enjoyable, but you know who all the characters are. You basically know how they're going to react in any given situation. And the drama is like, how is Superman going to beat them this time?
Yep.
Whereas in a book like this, or Doom Patrol, you have no idea what's going to happen next. A character could turn out to be the figment of another character's imagination, and it's only like the third weirdest twist that might happen in that issue, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a lot of fun. I'm enjoying the series. I think probably Doom Patrol is the one of the young animal books I'm enjoying the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's,
I like it too. It was weird when I first picked it up.
That's the franchise
strange,
that I have the most history with, because I've read dozens of the classic Doom Patrol issues, and then I read all of Grant Morrison's run from the 80s. So.
This run is my introduction to the entire concept of the Doom Patrol, but I'm enjoying it so far. It's very strange and random and full of weird events and connections.
Well, that's the Doom Patrol.
Yep. Well, there you go. But it is fun.
Yeah. And that's it.
Nice.
So, should we move on to your quiz?
Sure, I am ready.
So this week, in honor of, in celebration of, and in deference to the my pick of Cave Carson as the comic, and also the fact that the premiere of Justice League Action is coming up in a few weeks, and will feature a large roster of obscure DC characters, I am going to quiz you on superheroes' secret identities.
Ooh, yay! I think I have a chance.
So I will tell you their...
Clark Kent!
I will tell you their... Well, the opposite. I'm going to tell you their civilian identity, ooh, and you need to tell me what their superhero name is.
Okay, cool. Even cooler. Okay.
Okay.
Superman!
So number one.
Yes.
Jason Blood.
He's the Red... No. Yeah, Red Hood. No. Jason Blood is Etrigan.
Very good.
Yay! Woohoo! Okay.
All right. Number two.
Uh-huh.
Michael John Carter.
Oh, he is Steel?
No.
No, he is...
You only get two guesses here, otherwise it's going to be a long time.
Iron.
Iron?
I don't know.
Iron of the Metal Men?
Iron of the Metal Men.
No. Michael John Carter is Booster Gold.
Oh, bother. Okay.
All right. Number three.
Uh-huh.
Jaime Reyes.
Oh, Blue Beetle.
Correct.
Woohoo.
All right.
Uh-huh.
Number four.
Uh-huh.
Cassandra Cain.
Cassandra... Do they call her Kate by any chance? Cause then...
No, different. Spelt with a C.
Cassandra Cain. Oh, it's going to kill me. I don't know.
Orphan.
Really?
Yeah, you knew that.
No, I didn't. I didn't know what her name was. I only ever knew her as Orphan.
Well, people call her Cassandra.
I heard her Cassie, but I didn't.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. All right. Okay. Or Cass.
Well, her name is so similar to Kate Kane because they're both, what's the best way to put it? They're both sort of rebooted modernizations of the original Catherine Kane Batwoman.
Oh.
So Kate Kane is like the modern version of the original Batwoman. Cassandra Kane was created when they didn't want to do another Batwoman, but they wanted to have someone carrying that name and legacy, so they created Cassandra Cain. But then they decided to bring Kate Kane back as a modern character anyway. So now there's two characters with similar names, except they're spelled with C's instead of K's, and this is supposed to be a coincidence.
Okay. Well, very cool anyway.
Number five.
Uh-huh.
Garfield Logan.
Oh, I have no idea. Let me take a shot in the jar.
People call him Gar all the time. Is that help? Gar, short for Garfield?
Beast Boy.
Very good.
Yeah. That does help, actually. Okay.
Right. Number six.
Uh-huh.
Cliff Steele.
Is it Steel?
No.
Cliff Steele. Oh, man. Vigilante?
No.
Okay. Well, those were my two guesses. Go ahead.
Robot Man from Doom Patrol.
Oh, bother. We were just talking about it. I should have known that. Oh, I should have just thought about it. It sounded...
More people call him Cliff than Robot Man.
Robot Man. Yeah, they do. Okay.
Number seven.
Uh-huh.
Khalid Nasur.
He's Dr. Fate.
Correct.
Yay!
All right.
Uh-huh.
Number eight.
Uh-huh.
Alan Scott.
Is he Alan Scott? Wait, is he the Green Lantern?
Correct. The original.
Yes! Woohoo!
Number nine.
Uh-huh.
Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson. Wait a minute. I don't know. I will guess and say the following words, which I'm thinking in my head.
What if I told you that he was Deathstroke's son? Would that help?
Yes, that would help. What was it? Ravager?
No, that's wrong son or daughter, depending on which Ravager you're talking about.
I was so close. Did somebody else pick up the Deathstroke mantle then?
No.
Okay.
He has a different name entirely.
Dr. Icon?
No.
He stole the suit, though.
That's true. No, Jericho is his name.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know his name. I mean, I didn't know his superhero name. I knew somebody was Ravager, but I couldn't remember Jericho.
That's okay.
All right.
And number 10,
uh-huh.
Katar Hall.
Oh, He's Hawkman.
Correct.
Yay.
Very good.
So I think I got 6 out of 10 on that.
Yes, you did.
Hooray.
Not bad.
Yay. I'm actually really proud of myself. Woohoo. That was a great quiz. Wow. And you put it together so quickly. We originally thought we wouldn't have a quiz this week, but then you just pulled that one out of the air. Nicely done, Oni. That was a lot of fun. He's making a face. Again, fantastic move for an audio format. Anyway.
Should we talk about our shows?
Yes, it's time to talk about our shows.
So the episode of Star Wars Rebels this week was called Iron Squadron.
Yes, it was very good.
I wasn't crazy about this one. I thought that the characterization and character arcs in the episode were kind of contrived and one-dimensional. I feel like this is... We keep seeing, the show keeps showing us this at least the second or third episode where we see a bunch of kids that are fighting in the rebellion and over their heads. But the thing about this episode is I thought that the kids were kind of, the main guy especially, I can't even remember his name now. Was it Mart or something like that, right?
Yeah.
You're
right.
I thought he was kind of annoying. And the thing about him was that he didn't really learn any kind. He didn't have any arc. He didn't really learn any lesson by the end. Like he was in over his head the whole time.
Yep.
But never really acknowledged that he was until the end when a Star Destroyer showed up and he's like, oh, I guess that's a Star Destroyer. But then our guys came and saved him. And then at the end, he's like fist pumping his friends and cheering. And so I was like, first of all, you didn't do anything. Second of all, you almost got all the others killed. And third, like, I never got the sense that he learned what a Star Destroyer looked like. But they never gave the character a moment where he was like breaking down or crying or whatever and saying like, oh no, I was so wrong. Like I've endangered my friends.
Well, he didn't say it outright, but I disagree with you because when that Star Destroyer came out, he knew he was in over his head. Not only that, but he also felt it when they were facing whatever the Star Destroyer's 1/6 of a size was, the ship that came after the transporter that they destroyed. You know the one I'm talking about, the one that came before. What they were taking a crack at it, he thought that was a Star Destroyer, but he was intimidated by it, but he still, you know, took a swing at it. But when the Star Destroyer came out, that oh crap expression on his face, so that's much more due to the animators than anything. I don't think there was time to give him a giant soliloquy about the wrongness of his
ways. He realized he was in over his head, and he got out of there. But
he tried to run. Is that that's the point? Because he didn't try to stand and fight at that point. He was on the run.
I just felt like this guy screwed up and endangered his friends all episode, and then eventually he decided that I was like, oh, time to cut and run. And then he was celebrating with his friends at the end. I'm like, what did you do that's worthy of celebration?
Well, he was celebrating the fact that they were all together again, and they were still full of youthful
friends.
But
his friends were so diehard on his side until Ezra said to them, you know, you really shouldn't be so cavalier. There's the Empire is more powerful than you think. And then all of a sudden, his friends are on Ezra's side and telling Mart to abandon the cause. And it was like a light switch. There was no scene where they were forced to reconsider their past actions or question themselves. It's just like Ezra's like, you know, you guys are wrong. And then at the beginning of the next scene, they're like, Mart, we're so wrong. Like, how could it's like, wait a minute, are you that easy to convince? Like, I just felt like the characterization of his buddies there was paper thin, and that the Mart character himself, while he was smart enough to get out of a no-win situation,
yeah,
still didn't feel like he really grew or learned anything. Like, because at the beginning, he would have been smart enough to, if this massive ship appeared, he would have been smart enough to run probably then too. It's just he'd never been put in that situation. So he didn't really grow. He was just presented with a new situation and he reacted the way he probably always would have reacted because he's not an idiot. He knows that he has no chance of winning that fight. He's been fighting easy fights all along and that's why he's been winning. When presented with a hard fight, he cut and ran and then acted as if he was some big hero celebrating with his friends. It just rubbed me the wrong way. Like the new characters felt paper thin. And
they were paper thin. I mean,
really,
if you have to introduce somebody, give them an arc and a conclusive endpoint in a 20-minute show for three people,
it can be
that's
done.
Hard.
It can be done. Look at all the DCs, all the Batman, Superman, Justice League shows. Like they would introduce characters. They would introduce a bunch of characters in 20 minutes, and you'd give them an arc over the course of the show. It's not impossible. Even this show has done it. Mm-hmm. This show's done it a bunch of times. I'm also getting sick of episodes where where the whole episode is about recruiting a bunch of new characters into the rebellion, and then we never see those characters again. Yeah. It's like, what did we just spend 20 minutes? Like, do you honestly think we're ever? Well, maybe we'll see Mart again.
It's true.
I kind of hope we don't. But even if we do, it's like, okay.
We saw Wedge Antilles being recruited.
Yeah, we might see him again. But then there was that episode where Sabine recruited Gina Torres's character, and then we saw her like once briefly after that. Yeah. And it's like, why are we? You know, like tell further the stories of the characters that we know.
Yeah,
you know, wrap up some of the loose ends from previous seasons, like Ahsoka and the Darth Maul stuff. That's the interesting stuff. We don't want to see them recruit a bunch of snot-nosed kids into the rebellion that we then never see again. Like, this felt like a filler episode to me.
Huh. You're not wrong.
It didn't
about
advance
that.
Any of the main character stories. Didn't. It didn't advance the overarching story at all, because once again, we had Thrawn come in and let our guys go because he had felt he had learned some vital piece of information and didn't need to deal with them now. I'll let them live to fight another day, kind of thing, which is the second or third time he's done that. That's wearing a little
at
thin,
least,
too.
Yeah.
So it just felt like another, like, you could, this was such a paint by numbers.
Do you think,
like,
this is,
snot-nosed kids, check. Recruiting characters into the rebellion that we don't really care about, check. Thrawn decides to let our guys go at the end.
Check.
For no reason, no real reason, check. Yeah. Like, it just felt like such a standard filler episode to me.
I don't think you're wrong about that. I think that it was a little bit more gray than the black and white that you seem to be taking away from it. But you're not wrong in that it's starting to be a little bit formulaic. I mean, you've even got the same number of people that they recruit. It's not exactly a plot-rich story. But I did enjoy it. And I, what do you think? Do you think they're building up to something more conclusive, more concrete at the end of the season or towards the end of the season? Or do you think it's just going to be filler episodes for season
two? No, I think they're building to something. I think the whole thing between Ezra and Maul and then the thing with Thrawn manipulating, moving people around like chess pieces.
Yeah, but like we said in the beginning, when we first were introduced to Thrawn, it's going to get paper thin if our guys keep bumping into him and somehow he keeps letting them go. Like, it's not going to make a lot of sense after a while. We've reached that point.
I think they could redeem it if at the end of the season, the writers manage to have him exact some terrible toll from the rebellion. And we see how all his machinations throughout the season have led to him being able to do this.
Yeah.
And he strikes the rebellion. Maybe he strikes them really hard and Commander Sato dies, goes down with the ship and, you know, like a bunch of the other, like maybe they lose, maybe not one of the main characters dies necessarily, but he strikes some major victory against the rebellion that scatters our characters or does something.
True.
I think that would kind of retroactively redeem it.
So here's a curveball question that's actually related to what you just said. We have Rogue One coming out very soon. Do you think that and it takes place in the same timeline as this?
A little later.
No, Ships of the Death Star taking away. This is right before A New Hope, and so is this.
Well, Star Wars Rebels Season 1 took place several years before A New Hope, and we don't really know how much time has passed. Probably 2 or 3 years based on Ezra's appearance.
Ezra's age, yeah.
So now we're anywhere from maybe like a year or two before A New Hope, and we don't know when Rogue One takes place relative to New Hope, but one would assume like immediately before. So we might still be
not immediately, but
it might be.
Pretty
I mean,
close.
For all we know, the last shot of Rogue One might be the
first
Death
shot
Star
of
plans being put into
R2's
being given to the crew
Leia.
Of the Tent of Four and Princess Leia's ship flying off to escape that Star Destroyer. Like, that could be the end of Rogue One for all we know. It might lead up to the minute that Episode 4 starts. We don't know. Because once the Rebels get those plans, not going to wait a year to use them.
It might take them a year to get them to where they need to go. But my point is that actually kind of suits my purpose, which is that you have Rogue One coming up. So the events of that movie could tie into the events of the animated series that we're watching. Do you think that maybe they're slowing down some of the plot points to lead up to some of the things that are going to happen in Rogue One?
I don't think they're slowing down, because I think that all these things were
planned
out years ahead
of time.
Sure,
but
it's not like
filler episodes.
It's not like the timing of Rogue One release took them by surprise.
I understand, but I'm saying that this is deliberate filler in order to space out what they need to happen.
No, I don't think so. I think it would have been cool if they tied into Rogue One, but I think at this point it seems like they're not going to do it. Because I think the thing, if they were going to tie into Rogue One, the thing to do would have been to like structure this season around leading up to Rogue One. Because now Rogue One is a couple weeks away from being released, and there's been nothing. And these episodes are completed so far ahead of time that I think if they were going to tie into Rogue One, it would have been
more obvious.
Kind of like the way that season one of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in retrospect was structured around the lead up to and the aftermath of Captain America: The Winter Soldier. I think if they'd wanted to do something similar with Rebels, this season would have been structured around
doing that,
revolving around Rogue One, both leading up to it and then dealing with the aftermath of it. And there's been zero hint of that. Like, how hard would it have been to have Jyn Erso show up in a cameo in a couple of episodes this season as some outlaw that the crew has to tolerate? And then in Rogue, we go see Rogue One, and she's actually brought into the rebellion. And I'll be like, oh, cool. Like, you know,
yeah.
But they haven't done. And I think that if they were going to do something like that, they would have been trumpeting it. They would have been marketing it by now.
Hmm.
You know,
well, that sounds
only,
like a lost
there's only like one more episode between now and when Rogue One comes out, and there's been nothing. Like, like when Darth Vader was going to show up on Rebels, there was a huge marketing blitz behind that.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think if they were going to do something like that, we would know about it. It seems like a bit of a missed opportunity to me.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Especially since the Star Wars universe is really well integrated into all of its own.
It is a little surprising, but it might have to do with the fact that the show is marketed to a much younger audience than even the movies are, and especially I feel like
of
the movies.
Doesn't matter, right? Because you can tell good stories that all tie into one another, and it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be the first time that these big companies, sometimes they worry about cross-pollinating different series within the same franchise if they're trying to position them, if they're trying to aim those different series at different audiences.
Yeah. Well, I can understand how the Marvel universe wants to keep itself separate from the movies and the TV shows, but this doesn't make a lot of sense. Star Wars is known for being like, you know, they're taking stuff out of the books and they're putting it into this show.
But it's the same reason why Marvel hasn't had any of the Netflix characters show up anywhere else, is because those shows are aimed at a much more mature audience, and one of the reasons is that they wouldn't want to necessarily entice, you know, 10-year-olds that are watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on ABC or whatever to go watch the Netflix stuff and then be scandalized by it. It's the same reason why, even going back to the 90s, Warner Brothers didn't let Bruce Timm and Paul Dini use characters like Swamp Thing or Phantom Stranger, any of the Vertigo characters, on Batman the Animated Series. Because the Vertigo comics were aimed at more mature audiences.
Understood.
And we don't want even the appearance of overlap between our kids' Batman show and these mature comics. Because we don't want angry parents writing and saying, my son loved Phantom Stranger on your cartoon, and so I went and got him a Swamp Thing comic and there were naked women in it, and now I'm blaming you and suing you. Like, they don't need the headache. So oftentimes these big companies try to keep a firewall up between different, even if it does all take place in one universe.
Yeah.
I've seen so many instances of that. So it could be that a little bit too. It's hard to tell.
That makes sense.
Plus these cartoons, the lead time on them, I mean, there's a huge lead time on a movie too. These movies take years to make, and so do cartoons. And just the timing of it might have been hard to, like, when they started production on season 3 of Star Wars Rebels, they might not have even known what year it was going to air in.
Hmm.
You know? So it might have been very hard to coordinate this kind of stuff. It's a little easier with Marvel with the live action stuff, because the live action shows are produced on more or less on a weekly basis. And so they kind of know ahead of time which week this episode is going to air in, so they can have it lead into the latest movie. But it would be far harder to coordinate something like this. So I think it's probably a variety of reasons.
Understood.
So Gotham this week. So this episode was called Time Bomb. I thought there was some good stuff in this episode. I thought the stuff with Nygma interrogating/torturing Butch and Tabitha was interesting, because it's a very complex. There's a lot going on there, because, you know, Nygma is mistaken about his assumptions about Butch's involvement. Butch doesn't know what's going on, but wants to, but might be willing to say that he does in order to save Tabitha. Tabitha might be able to say, might be willing to say some things to save Butch, but maybe not quite as much, because maybe he feels more strongly for her than she does for him. Meanwhile, Barbara is trying to find Nygma because she's worried about Tabitha. So there's sort of an interesting web of things going on there on that whole side of the story. The stuff with Bruce and Selina running into this group that's trying to fight the Court of Owls is interesting, and the Court of Owls is finally named for the first time in this episode. We also see I'm going to call him the Talon, because I don't really know what else to call a Court of Owls enforcer, but that same Talon guy that attacked Alfred in Wayne Manor back at the beginning of the season takes on these guys and makes pretty short work of them.
No kidding.
So now the question is, did he overhear whatever the Ukrainian leader's name was. Did he overhear that guy saying on the phone that they're going to ally with the kid?
Yeah.
Right? Because if so, then the Talon could now tell the court that Bruce is conspiring
reneging
against
them.
Yeah. Does he even know they were there, which would be just as bad.
Right.
That they're involved with this whole key thing.
Yeah, but they don't know about the fact that they found the second key, so that's good. They only know that they're looking for
it. Depends on how much
he
overheard from that guy
and
whether
he
was able to get any information out of any of the other goons that he might have tortured
sliced
and killed
pieces,
in the area. Let's see, what else? Well, there's the whole thing, of course, with Mario being his life being threatened.
Yep.
We had all sorts of theories during the episode about who might be behind trying to kill Mario.
Yep.
It looks like we were probably wrong because now it seems like the court was trying to kill him. But why, we don't fully know. It's obviously involved the fact that he has the Tetch virus.
Yes.
We don't know how he got it, whether he was infected intentionally,
yep.
by whom, and whether or if this is related to the court wanting him dead.
Right.
So there's a lot we don't know. It's interesting that Carmine Falcone is now willing to get back into the game to protect his son.
Yeah. Is it that interesting, or is it what you would call predictable? Because I would call it predictable.
Well, I don't know. Like, he's been out of the game for 2 seasons now.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't even appear, I think, at all last season. So bringing him back now and setting up a war between
him and the Court
the
of
crime
Owls.
Crime family of Gotham and the Court of Owls, with our character sort of caught in the middle without really understanding what this war is that's being fought, could be interesting.
Yeah.
I feel like Gotham has like a gang war every other week.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not, it kind of becomes a bit it's become a running gag in the comics.
Remember the
DC recap guys that I used to listen to would always joke about it. You know what's happening in Gotham? Is it a gang war? That's right. You know, it's like every other week there's a gang
funny.
War in Gotham.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, they were sitting in the limo, him and the woman, Catherine, representative of the Court of Owls, i.e. spokesperson, i.e. CEO, whatever. She told him, you know, Gotham is on the brink. And I'm like, when is it not on the brink?
I feel like it's one of those things, you know, what always reminds me of is Smallville, where all the characters would tell Clark that he has a great destiny. It's like, we know that because we know that he becomes Superman later, but how do you know that? And it's like in the show, all the characters are talking about how Gotham is on the brink. It's like, we know things get really bad before Batman arrives, but you don't know that because you're people that exist in this world. So why do you think the city? Because from the outside,
it's already pretty bad.
From the outside, it seems like if anything, it's probably better off now than it was when Penguin and Fish were warring in the streets and there were crazy monsters running around everywhere. Like if anything, things seem better now than they did a year ago.
Exactly.
So I mean, it feels a little meta that the characters are always talking about that. But whatever. I did think so. Our theory as we were watching the episode, or at least my theory, was that Carmine himself was behind the attack on his son.
Yeah, that
was
an
idea you had.
Of course,
didn't actually intend his son any harm. Had staged these things very carefully to only make it look like his son was being targeted. And the reason for that being either A, to provide him with a pretense to get back into the mob scene.
Yep.
B, as a way to motivate his son to possibly get more involved in the mob scene. He himself, Carmine, is dying and he wants to leave the business to his son.
And I had
to either break up
Mario
and Lee somehow. That would have seemed a little contrived.
Well, no, it wouldn't have, right? Because parents kind of distant. Parents have a different point of
but
view
how would
on
that
who
have
they
worked?
Whatever.
Would you have hoped that Mario would have left her for her own safety?
Well, let me further explain the whole idea because we're talking in half sentences. The third idea was that Carmine was trying to break up Lee and his son from getting married because he detected that Lee still had feelings for Gordon.
Sure, but how would that have worked? Why would Mario have left her because of these attacks?
Because of the attacks? Maybe something would have come to light. I don't know. Maybe he would have... I'm not sure. Maybe Gordon would have shown his colors at that point or
maybe. That
something.
That seems like
it was a bit of a reach. It was a bit of a reach, yeah. But that was also a plausible theory. I mean, they've had thinner plot.
Yeah,
points.
I could have bought it happening. But that's the kind of thing. Like in reality, there's no way he could have possibly known that would have been the outcome.
Yeah,
in TV logic,
because Gotham plot points really draw upon reality.
Yeah. But overall, I thought it was interesting. I mean,
it was good.
It's a little over the top. The biker assassins with swords attacking him outside the hospital.
I don't know how you extract a tooth with a knife. That's all I'm wondering about. Remember the interrogation scene?
Yeah, I thought that was okay. But if those assassins wanted him dead, why didn't they just shoot him with a sniper rifle from the roof? Like, why did the two guys on a motorcycle
with
swords? Like, why?
Bulletproof helmets, remember?
Yeah, Gordon shot them like 10 times.
Yeah. And they're coming after him with a machete?
Inefficient way to kill
They're
someone.
Professionals. Are they? Are they? I don't know. But, okay. Well, so that's Gotham, I suppose.
Yeah,
we'll
so
figure out what
there's
what
only.
Else is
so
next.
There's one more episode before the mid-season break.
Oh, it'll be a good
and,
one. Though.
And if it's anything like last year, they do pretty long mid-season breaks. Like last year, there were like 3 months without Gotham episodes. It was gone from December till like March or something like that.
Yeah.
And then it came back and they did 10 episodes pretty
they
much
They did a Chekhov's
through.
Gun element too, which we forgot to mention, which is that Lee at the very beginning of the episode when she, Carmine, and Mario are talking right before the rehearsal dinner day, and she mentions in passing that as part of her work that's going well, the lab she's connected with finally developed a test to detect whether somebody has the Tetch virus. And we saw a shot of Mario and her sitting, you know, right at the table, just eye lines that was shot. And I'm like, oh, that's going to come in handy at some point. And by the end, we discover that Mario has the Tetch virus, which we forgot to mention. Because he was stalking Jim and he sort of went a little ballistic on two guys that were trying to mug him at the end there. So there you go. Chekhov's virus.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that was the last plot point. But yeah, it's going to be an exciting next episode. So that'll be fun.
Yep.
Okay.
So Supergirl this week. So this episode was called The Darkest Place.
Yeah.
So in this episode, Supergirl is captured by Cadmus.
Yep.
Along with Mon-El.
Yep.
And they are not really in... Well, I guess I'm not.
They're nth metal.
They're not
cage.
Really, not really interrogated, not really tortured. So, but they shot Mon-El. They kind of speechified at them a little bit, and they took some of Supergirl's blood. I wanted to say for some reason, but I guess at the end of the episode we learned what the reason was. We also,
did we?
Yeah, because Cyborg Superman went to the Fortress of Solitude with the blood and used it to gain access to the fortress's systems
or
something.
I forgot. And you finally got your Cyborg Superman.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, we talked about this going back a year now.
More than that.
When they cast David Harewood as Hank Henshaw.
Yeah.
And throughout the first 7 or 8 episodes of the first season where he would do something mysterious and his eyes would glow red and the camera would play, like, evil music. We're like, oh, he's... Because in the comics, he's Cyborg Superman. He's a villain.
Yep.
And then he was revealed to be John Jones. But now, of course, we get the real Hank Henshaw has become the Cyborg Superman. So it all... It's what, just like we were talking about last week with... who is Prometheus going to be, or who is Dr. Alchemy going to be? Like, sometimes, even though they take a long, twisted way to get there, they usually end up arriving at something which is true to the comics.
Yes.
Like, it took them a very twisty road,
sure.
But finally Hank Henshaw became Cyborg.
Well, remember, this is Earth 33, or whatever we decided to call it.
Well, the producers said that in the first season, they would jokingly call it Earth CBS, but they can't do that anymore. So now I think they're calling Earth S or something for Earth Supergirl, but that makes my brain explode, because in the comics, Earth S was where all the Fawcett comics characters like Captain Marvel used to live. So that's very confusing to me.
If you say so, that's so cute.
They can't call it Earth 2 or Earth 3 or Earth... I guess they could call it Earth 19, but that
I
would...
I called it Earth 33, but that wouldn't... No, that
why
wouldn't
33?
Explain... Because that's a number that I like. I don't know.
All
right. But it wouldn't make sense because HR... Well, we're jumping to Flash now, but HR has never mentioned Earth 19 having a Supergirl, so...
Yeah, so it could be any other one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think they'd probably just call it Earth. I'm not sure they'll ever name it, but they could
Although,
call it.
Maybe that's how they do the crossover.
I'd be surprised if
wait a minute.
I'd be surprised if they... I would actually be surprised if they name it, because by giving it any other... Because you can call the Earth your series is taking place on Earth 1, like the other shows do, because...
Or Earth Prime.
It's the show we're... Because it's the show we're... It's the Earth we're watching, so it's the most important Earth.
Sure.
But if they call this, like, Earth 23 or something...
Yeah.
And then you feel... Then now you're watching a show that takes place on Earth 23. You feel like you're
diminished.
Watching some second-rate Earth. You're like,
I
don't want to watch this crummy Earth. Show me the... You know? But if it's never named, you can sort of trick yourself into thinking this is just as important.
This is just an important...
But as
yeah.
soon as you assign a number to it, which is why they used to go, like, Earth S or Earth X or something to make them seem different
Give
but
them
equal.
Names,
different
right. Because if they have names, yeah. But anyway, back to Supergirl.
But yeah, so it's interesting. So Mon-El was shot, and they finally introduced the lead poisoning aspect of it, although it works differently here, because here It's not enough to be exposed to lead. It seems like it actually needs to
be injected,
in his body.
Yeah.
And also the fact that it can be reversed just by removing the lead. Whereas in the comics, if he was like in the same room as lead, he would begin to die and nothing could save him. Like it doesn't,
That's a bum rap.
It seemed like he was.
Can you think of a real people allergy that has the same effect? I mean, aside from something toxic, like, I don't know.
No, not really. Aside from like some poison gas or something.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that when he was in the cell, it sounded like he was about to tell Supergirl something about Daxamites. And then stuff happened to stop him. Was he just going to tell her that lead is particularly poisonous to them? But she could tell that from the fact that it was able to penetrate his skin.
Maybe he's dying and nobody will tell. I mean, he won't tell her.
Could be. I felt like he was about to reveal something about their race. Not just like, because at the end of this was like, oh, was he going to profess his feelings for her or something? But no, because he said there's something I need to tell you about Daxamites.
Huh.
So I don't know.
Maybe about their mating rituals? I don't know.
It could be. I don't know.
Because he was
talking
about that
at the
end
there. I feel like that was
planting
something
for
later and we don't know what it was.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's cute at the end, though, when he's
like, has she chosen one yet?
Yeah, that part's cute. And, so what else? We see Dean Cain again.
Yes, we
do. I didn't see his name at the beginning. I wonder if they held his name as they sometimes do. But they didn't show it at the end either. So was he uncredited? Maybe it was at the beginning and I just missed it. But I do try to read the
credits
the
as they're going up.
Because I like to know, like, oh, so that must be the person that plays. Like I try to be aware of who's in the episode and who's playing who, just so I can, you know, because we talk about it here and I like to know these things. So.
Sure.
And I didn't see his name go by, but I might have been distracted if something particularly exciting was happening. But that was cool. What's interesting is that he seems like he's working for them because
yes.
he had an access card. And I guess he could have taken it from a guard or something, but he also didn't seem like he was beaten or malnourished or something.
Yeah.
So I think that
that's what I was going to ask.
They think that they've indoctrinated him and now he's one of them, but he's
right.
secretly plotting against them probably.
I think it's the reverse. I think they have indoctrinated him.
Oh, you think he's
and
going to turn
he
out to be
revealed
a traitor?
Them because they already got what they, he released them because he already
so
got
you,
what he
so
needed
you think
out of them.
He's evil now.
I do.
I'm not sure
that's
they would
my theory.
Do that. I don't think they would turn Dean Cain's character evil.
No, they wouldn't do that. They would turn him indoctrinated, but maybe not evil. Or maybe he's dead and like a robot now. Because they did the same thing with Hank Henshaw. I mean, Hank Henshaw is not really Hank Henshaw.
So.
He's just a
cyborg
now.
I think that you bring on like an elder statesman of the Superman world like Dean Cain onto your show and you don't. There's certain things you probably aren't going to do to his character just out of deference. I feel like you're probably not going to make him permanently evil. I feel like you're not going to give him an ignominious off-screen death and replace him with an evil cyborg.
He had an on-screen death, though.
Well,
I mean, remember the knife in the gut?
We thought he did, but then it turned out. So you thought the whole thing about him being alive in Cadmus might just be a ruse.
Exactly.
I'm not sure they would do that either. I feel like they're going to give him a happy ending. Or a heroic sacrifice where he sacrificed himself to destroy Cadmus and save his daughters or something.
That would be nice.
They're going to have him either have a happy ending or go out in a really heroic way. More heroic than the way he went out before,
yeah.
which is kind of a dark death in the middle of nowhere. Where,
yeah, that's
you know?
Super sad.
He did pretty. Aged pretty good for 15 years. I was trying to do the math in my head. He said he was in here for 15 years.
Yeah.
So how old? How long did he really get to be a father for Kara? Because how old was she when she arrived on Earth?
12, or so.
And 15. And if he's been here for 15 years,
I think he only had.
He must have only been. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
she's only in her mid-20s now.
Yeah, she's like 26 tops.
Yeah. I'm not sure she was 12 when she arrived on Earth. Does she look like she was 12 to you? I was going to say like 9 or 10.
Maybe younger.
So maybe,
I mean,
maybe like
between 10 and 12.
So like a year, maybe two.
Definitely
most,
pre-teen.
Where he was father to her.
Yeah.
And, okay, I mean...
It's kind of tough to gauge because when they do the flashback sequences, they use the same actress,
well,
which is nice, but
well,
she's
course.
Growing,
but I,
but which
you,
is...
You did get the sense that, like, when the original evil Hank Henshaw came to the Danvers and was basically blackmailing Jeremiah into working with them, you did get the sense that happened pretty soon after Kara arrived on Earth, right? So...
Did Kara ever mention what age she was when she came here?
I can't remember.
I can't either.
But anyway, so it does seem like... They only had maybe like a year, two max of being a happy family before Hank Henshaw kind of got them under his thumb and Jeremiah was going off doing missions with them and then ultimately one day didn't come back,
yeah.
right? But it just seems like her love for him and her desire to bring him home is obviously greatly informed by the fact that Alex, you know, cares a lot about him. But also she seems like she really loves him herself. And she even hugged him in this episode and was like, I love you, Dad, or something like that. It's like... I guess, but
she grew up with. Well, I mean, that's.
Yeah, but if you live in someone's house for a year when you're 10,
yeah.
Do you form that close of a bond with them?
Sure, why not?
And call them dad?
When you're a kid like that, you've just lost your entire planet and species.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, you could form attachments very quickly.
I feel like if you're a young kid,
you know, some
you can
kids. Write, I'll
latch
give you an example.
Someone like that very quickly.
I will
but
give
if you
an example. Hold on,
age,
hold on. I will give you an example. This is a prime example. Some kids who go to school remember their teachers. You have 10 months with a teacher, and some kids really form a long-lasting love for that teacher in that time. Now, if they can do that with a teacher, of course they can do that with a parent. At that
I
age.
I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, that's somebody that affected you, that loved you. You felt that love. And it's far more simple when you're a kid in terms of, like, understanding that.
But then 15 years later, are those feelings still as
strong? Of course. Especially when they're trying to save you. Especially when you see in their face that love hasn't changed for them either, you know? You can... That it triggers those memories again. It's like, wow, you still care. Like, and
maybe.
Not only that, but... You know, that it's, you're saving my hide right now. Of course, I'm going to come back for you.
Like, did it seem like a little out of nowhere to you that Hank Henshaw dubbed himself the cyborg Superman?
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Just like, what do you have to do with Superman?
It actually sounded funny. It actually cracked me up. I'm like, what? What? Where
for
does
a while,
Superman
he just,
fit into
for
anything?
A while, he just called himself, for a while, he was just called the cyborg. But I guess they probably don't want to do that because cyborg is a different character. Not that he's probably ever going to appear on these shows, but he's going to be in the movies and stuff. But... I mean, if they hate aliens, why would he want to have Superman in his name? It doesn't make a great deal of sense, aside from the fact that that's what he's called in the comics. I feel like we might have a new reigning champion for the whatever we used to call it, the Arsenal Award.
Oh yes, the like, wink wink
very,
Arsenal.
Very
yes.
Very clumsily sneaking in the name from the comics.
Yes.
To so a character can start calling themselves something.
Yeah, that was. That was inelegant,
have,
too.
Have,
it was like dismounting on your
you
face.
You didn't have Cisco there to give him,
no,
give him the name, so the characters just have to name themselves, and it doesn't...
They're left to their own devices, rudderless without Cisco. Anyway.
Yeah. But I thought it was a really good episode.
It was.
So next week...
I wonder if... oh, my God. Linda Carter? Oh, my God.
That's a person that exists, but I don't know where you're going with the
if
sentence.
She makes an appearance. Wonder Woman. Right.
Yes.
Yeah, if she comes back as president for this last... episode, right? Because this is also going to be the season break for Supergirl next week as well.
No, I don't think so.
It's going to lead
into
the crossover.
Next week's episode kicks off the crossover, but then I think there's another episode or two before the holidays.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I wonder if those last three or so episodes we're going to see Linda Carter come back and maybe understand what alien
I don't think she's going to be back before the holidays because they've released the blurbs. Which also have the guest cast attached.
Oh,
and
okay.
I don't remember seeing her mentioned in there.
Okay.
I'm sure she'll be back later this season.
Talk about spoilers. I'm glad
I
don't read those things. I'm like, I wonder what happens next. And you're like, well, they didn't have this.
Well, they do
and
a pretty
like,
good job of keeping the, like the Dean Cain thing I didn't know was coming.
That's
but
true.
It's just if someone is going to be credited at the beginning of the episode and have a substantive guest role, they're
it's
usually mentioned
tough,
in the press
It's kind of
tough,
right, for this show because everybody wants to know the show. But if you release the names of the people that are in the show, you might spoil some of the events in the show. And yet, actors want to be credited for their work, and understandably so. So it's kind of a tough tightrope to walk, isn't it, honey? I think it is. I don't know. Anyway.
So this week's episode of Flash was
Flash.
Killer Frost.
Yeah.
So this was the second episode directed by Kevin Smith.
Oh. Cool.
Oh, you forgot that?
Yeah, I completely forgot. Yes, I did. I'm so terrible. I don't really know if I notice any differences with the directing style. Like, do you think they have...
A TV show has a certain directorial style, which is established by whoever directs the pilot, and then it usually stays pretty
stable.
That's why they say movies are a director's medium and television is a writer's medium. Because when you come in to direct the TV show, you're really just you're filling a role and you're making the show look like the show is supposed to look. And
Understood.
You can maybe add a bit of your own flourishes
elements
to it, but
to
not
it.
As much.
Right.
Whereas if a guest writer comes in to write an episode, they can really do sometimes just crazy off the wall stuff.
Interesting.
But yeah, I feel like. I mean, his episode last season, which was the, I keep wanting to call it Dinosaurs on a Spaceship or The Good Dinosaur, too many dinosaur titles. The one where Barry was trapped in the Speed Force and his mother and him looked at the dinosaur book. I mean, that was such
that was
a different
great.
Kind of episode that you would say, oh, wow, that was the Kevin Smith episode. It was so different, so poignant. But that I think feel like that episode would have carried a big emotional punch and would have been very different regardless of who had directed it. And he did a great job. But that was the concept for that episode, which was...
Somehow, though, I do remember it looking visually different.
But I think that was because it was in the Speed Force and they were doing all sorts of it. But, and a lot of those were probably his ideas. But if a different director had done that episode, they probably would have done visually different things to make it seem different because it was in the Speed Force also. Whereas this episode, it was the regular cast and the regular world doing regular things.
In the regular sets, in the regular camera angles.
It's going to seem more like a standard episode.
Sure.
But I still, I mean, it was well directed, but I think if you'd put this episode, taken his name off it, put this episode up alongside every other episode we've gotten so far this season, I don't think I would have been able to tell you which one would have been directed.
That's why I didn't know.
But anyway, so that was a noteworthy thing about the episode, but... So this one focuses a lot on, so I guess the two main things in this episode, well, three main things. So there's the Wally West stuff.
Yep.
There's the Killer Frost stuff.
Yep.
And then there's the Dr. Alchemy / Savitar
dun,
stuff.
Dun, dun. Yeah.
So we get a better look at Savitar here, and he doesn't really look anything like he does in the comics. You've seen, I think, pictures of what he looks like in the comics. He's a speedster. He's got darker skin because he's non-Caucasian. He's got long black hair. He's like shirtless, and then he has like this gold blue kind of armor over parts of his body and his legs, and this sort of crown around his head, kind of. He's distinctive looking, but he doesn't look anything like he does in the show. In the show, he kind of looks like
an alien, kind
like a shiny blue
robot
glass
thing. Martian type thing,
which is interesting, but
it's as if a white Martian was putting on armor, kind of.
Yeah, I mean his attitude seems to be similar in that he sees himself as like the god of the Speed Force and wants to bring worshippers to himself and indoctrinate others and so on. So that part is similar. He's kind of like a cult. He's like kind of like if
a cult leader.
Yeah, he's an evil speedster as cult leader, basically.
Yeah.
Here he does seem to be like way more powerful. Also,
he does.
I mean, in the comics, he was a powerful speedster, but you know, the Flash could
beat
him. Whereas here, he was. Yeah, it seems like he's operating at a whole other level. And then, of course, at the end, we find out that Julian is Dr. Alchemy, which you know, like we talked about last week. Sometimes
Good
they
guess.
Do the obvious thing.
Yep.
Although the way it's played with Savitar's voice kind of haunting him almost makes it sound like he's not doing it fully.
Of his own volition. I agree. And not only that, but if you remember how Wally West, this is tying into the plot from earlier, Wally West was really possessed to be drawn to alchemy in the first place. I mean, this is exactly, he was haunted, he was kind of borderline controlled.
It's kind of interestingly ironic for Julian too, because as someone who hates metahumans, it's ironic that he's secretly creating new metahumans.
Yes.
And one could say that, is that irony, or is the fact that he's like maybe subconsciously aware that this is what he's doing at night, which is leading to his hatred? Maybe the reason why he knows that metahumans can be so dangerous is because deep down in his mind, he knows that he's creating dangerous metahumans.
And being controlled by one,
yeah,
maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it actually makes a great deal of sense. The Wally stuff I thought was cool. I thought that... when he's cut out of the cocoon by Joe and HR.
Yep.
And I feel like it was handled appropriately dramatically where there's an explosion and you see that he's a speedster now, he's vibrating.
And he can't control it.
He can't control it. I feel like his joy at finally being a speedster is very much in line with...
Yes.
That seems correct, and that seems like what I was hoping. I mean, the whole idea...
He's so excited.
The whole idea
it.
Of having it sort of tainted by the dark machinations of this evil villain that put him in this cocoon and like all that stuff is sort of like... seemed unnecessary for the traditional Kid Flash origin story. It seems like a little bit of, you didn't need to darken it up that much, but I feel like it kind of redeems itself by just like his, if he'd been haunted, like, can I trust these powers if they were given to me by someone so evil? But the fact that he seems so overjoyed to finally be a speedster is very, like, that's very Kid Flash. So I'm happy with that. I feel like now it's only, I mean, now the countdown begins to when he actually puts on a costume. I feel like,
do you think he'll construct one out of the Speed Force? Because
that's a thing that he can do in the comics, but Wally can only do that in the comics because he was the Flash for so many years after Barry died, and because now he was the main Flash, the writers felt comfortable in having him surpass things that Barry had ever been able to do.
Huh, okay.
Like he was the first speedster to ever actually, like, during Barry's whole run up until his death in 1985, the Speed Force wasn't even a concept. That was introduced during Mark Waid's run on Wally as the Flash.
Got it.
Wally was the first speedster to become aware of what the Speed Force was, to enter into the Speed Force, and then successfully come out of it again. And when he came out, he had his powers had been kicked up a whole other notch because now he had a direct connection to the Speed Force, having been in it.
Yeah.
So he could do things no other speedster could do. He could lens speed and steel speed from other people or things.
Cool.
He could create energy and matter like out of the Speed Force, so he could create his costume around himself. Those were all things that Barry could never do, that they gave to Wally, because you want your current Flash that you're writing to seem like the ultimate Flash.
Sure.
But
the Flash.
Now that Barry's back as being the Flash in the comics, it's kind of tricky. Like, how do you distinguish the different speedsters without making one seem way more powerful than the others?
Sure.
And similarly on the show, it'd be cool if they gave Wally some different things that he can do that Barry, like one thing that was cool in the comics was that Bart Impulse could vibrate through objects without causing them to explode, which is something no other speedster had ever been able to do.
Yep.
But in the show, they have Barry vibrate through things all the time.
Yep.
Right. So I feel like it all kind of gets mushed together, but it would be cool if they gave Wally certain things he could do that the others couldn't do. In the comics though, you can really make his costume seem like it's been created out of the Speed Force, because you give it this otherworldly, shiny look to it that almost seems like he's coated in metal or something.
Yep.
Whereas in the show, you have to have him wearing leather or whatever, right? So it doesn't, I feel like it wouldn't quite, if they were able to have him look like Savitar or something, like maybe Savitar is creating his look out of Speed Force energy.
Yep.
That's kind of what, that would make more sense. But Wally's like yellow leather costume is like, I created this yellow leather out of the Speed Force. Like, I think that would seem kind of silly. Yeah, it'd be cool. It'd be cool to see when they suit him up.
I'm excited. Wally's grin as he's running around and even exceeding Barry in terms of setting records for how fast he could go when Barry first started.
Well,
being
I was waiting
Flash.
To see like, it. It's like I was saying, you got to be careful that now you don't make him seem better than Barry. So like, he's going faster than Barry did
at
when
the
he
beginning.
First became the Flash.
Yes.
It's like, careful now.
But he's so excited and ecstatic and just so happy. I'm wondering how, there's one little continuity problem. When the speedsters jump into that speed track in any way, shape or form, they're wearing sweat clothes. Do you remember in the very beginning of the Flash when they first established?
Yeah, they gave
like
that
Barry's,
up.
Yeah, Barry's clothes would catch on fire.
He speeds around
that's
in his everyday
thing.
Clothes all the time though. Like
they
gave that
up
really quick.
I know. Well, to be fair, I mean, he's so fast that he could strip of his clothes, run with them in his hand so that they don't frictionize and set on fire, and then get dressed again on site, and nobody would be the wiser.
Now, they probably wish they hadn't done that now in retrospect, but at the time, like...
No, it's such a cool thing to do, but it also makes sense. I'm glad they did.
But they felt like they needed to justify the costume. Now when a new hero shows up, they have a costume, and you don't even think about it anymore.
Well,
but when you think back to season one of The Flash, even over on Arrow, Oliver wasn't really wearing much of a costume back then. It was just the hood that he came back from the island with and some green leather.
But Cisco,
Barry was the first one to wear a costume, and so they felt like they needed to give it a reason to exist.
But that was a good reason.
It was a good reason, but now new superheroes show up in these shows and they just have costumes and you just accept it. So I feel like they dropped that really quick, because once people got used to the idea of these characters wearing colorful costumes, you didn't need to justify it anymore.
I don't think they fully let it go. I mean, I don't think they explain it every single time, which I actually appreciate, because that would get boring, but...
By your own logic, they went back on it, because now he speeds around without a suit on all the time, and his clothes never catch on fire.
Well,
so they
you never know, because Cisco may have like made sweat clothes for them to work out in. That's my only retcon. That's my mental retcon. You're right.
He runs around in his everyday clothes.
But at the
he
same
carries
time,
other characters. Like, he's sped around with Oliver before too, and Oliver's clothes don't catch on fire. Like, he carries characters and he pulls people in and out of the Speed Force and he pushes
again,
them out of the way at super speed.
Because you have to understand the physics of it. The friction, the reason why Barry's clothes set on fire was not because he was moving such a fast speed, but because he was rubbing his clothes back and forth. Effectively, like, if you rub two sticks together fast enough, you could start a fire.
Well, no, in reality, the friction caused by the resistance from the air would tear you apart, too. And the speeds he's traveling, like, the comics go into this sometimes, the speeds he's traveling, microscopic particles in the air would be hitting
would be
you
like
with such
bullets,
a speed that they would tear through you like bullets. So in the comics, the idea is that when he runs, he's tied into the Speed Force, and the Speed Force essentially generates like this
little
field around him that protects him.
Well, so then by that logic, if he's carrying somebody, they're protected as well.
So they could have used that explanation on the show, but instead they said that he needs this special suit and then basically abandoned that idea. Now, if they wanted to put a line in now that says you don't need to wear the suit anymore because now your connection to the Speed Force allows you to protect yourself, then they'd retroactively have explained the problem that the discrepancy that we've just spent 10 minutes talking about.
But by that same token, even though he's running fast and protecting himself from the elements of the outside, that's one thing that explains one part of it. But still, his arms and legs are moving at such a fast speed that if he's not wearing appropriate clothing, they're still going to be damaged unless technologically enhanced. Therefore, my retcon in my brain makes perfect sense, and I am once again super happy. Okay. I love geeky talks. Anyway.
So what about all the Killer Frost stuff?
I love it. It's very interesting. It's complex. It's tough because it's like, oh, look at these cool powers that she can use for good, but at the same time, they're turning her evil. But are they? But aren't they? But and there's this complexity that goes with it because Killer Frost is also her alter ego, which she's seen in full evil form. And she doesn't want to become that because she's a good person and she wants to help her friends. But every time she uses her powers, it's almost involuntary that she's being mean to people, that she's harming people, that she's kidnapping people, that she's, you know, becoming that alter ego that she doesn't want to be. And in her angry state, she's actually pulling out some pretty valid points to why, as to why Killer Frost would want to do harm to Barry, for example, because she can blame him for giving her these powers that she never wanted in the first place. She could blame him for hurting Cisco in terms of Flashpoint and you know, creating a timeline that none of them ever wanted and that ultimately killed Cisco's brother. And so you can see valid reasons. It's super well done and complex, but I really like her powers and I hope that she gets to have her cake and eat it too, that it's not actually a genetically altering state. It's more of a psychological thing that she can overcome and become kind of a good Killer Frost, which we were debating what would we call a good Killer Frost, because maybe like Saber Frost, or what did you say? You
no,
said Saber Frost, yeah.
Well, this episode establishes that she can, with great effort, kind of overcome it and
yes.
turn it off. But the question is, you know, if she continues to use the powers, will it get harder and harder to do so until finally she's not able to do that anymore? Or has this episode established that she has kind of learned how to suppress it and she can, you know, so they could go either way from here.
Yeah.
Hopefully they don't trot it out too often as, oh, is Caitlin turning evil again? Like,
yeah.
I feel like you can only do that so many times before it becomes repetitive. But So hopefully they won't fall into that trap. I feel like by calling this episode Killer Frost, it kind of implies that this is as close to the brink as she's going to get.
Yes.
Otherwise, you know, you call the episode where she does finally
Killer
become
Frost
Killer
too.
Frost, you call that Killer Frost.
Yeah,
know?
That's true.
But I'm not sure you can necessarily read too much into that. But yeah, no, I thought it was good. So next week, we get the big crossover, the Fortnite crossover. I think from what I've seen, the Supergirl episode. So it's interesting because it doesn't seem like it's going to be one 4-part story necessarily, where it's like one big story.
Oh, interesting. That's what I was expecting.
Like there's going to be threads. So there is a larger story that ties the episodes together. But it seems like the Supergirl episode is going to be telling its own story, and but then we'll kick off the crossover. And it seems like the Arrow episode, I think Flash and Legends of Tomorrow will probably be the most crossover heavy. Arrow, though, is actually the 100th episode of Arrow. And so they're doing a special episode that kind of pays homage to the show's history while at the same time trying to tie into the crossover. So I feel like it's not just going to be a continuation of the Flash episode. It's going to be doing its own thing and telling its own story that looks back at the history of the show and pays homage to all that and the people that have been on the show in the past and mm-hmm. stuff like that, while at the same time tying into the crossover. So
interesting. Okay.
So I feel like Flash and Legends of Tomorrow will probably be the heaviest. Supergirl will tell its own story, kick things off. Arrow will kind of be maybe like the, I don't know, like the calm before the final climax of the story, like all the characters are catching their breath and that will give Arrow time to reminisce and then it'll go into the thing. So I'm not sure if they're frustrated or happy that the 100th episode falls during the crossover, because now the episode really feels like it needs to serve two purposes, which are kind of at odds. If you want to do an episode, which is like...
They planned it deliberately. They did the math ahead of time. I mean, months ahead of time. And when you do the math, you can figure out which one is the 100th. And if you want to pay homage to it, it's kind of like deciding whether to celebrate a birthday.
Yeah, but they're kind of at the mercy of the schedule, though, because the 100th episode is going to be where it is. And if they want to do this crossover during November sweeps, it kind of has to be...
During this...
Maybe they could have had it be the 99th episode, but...
It's true. So even if they were backed into a corner where they're like, all right, it's going to fall over on these two timelines, so I guess we'll have to adjust our strategy. I mean, either way, I think that they'll they'll cover it. I think they've got it covered.
I just think that unlike, say, the Flash Arrow crossover last year, which was really just one story told over two nights, that you'll be able to tell that these are four distinct episodes from four distinct shows, but there will be story threads carrying from one to the other and climaxing. Yeah. Legends of Tomorrow will probably, as the fourth and final part, be the one that stands on its own the least. Like, that will be where everything climaxes. But I feel like the other three shows will probably be telling kind of their own story, but also forwarding the larger
story. So at the end of the Supergirl episode, when Hank Henshaw, Cyborg Superman, gets into the vault there and starts to dig around and uncover secrets and what have you, do you think that will be the impetus behind propelling her into the other Earth?
No, I don't think so. Because whatever Project Medusa or whatever it was called is, that's the title for the next episode is Medusa. So I feel like that's going to be the major thing in the next episode. But I think what brings her into the crossover is the Dominators invade and Barry uses the
Speed Force.
The gate, the thing that they have, that they pulled the different Harrison Wells through.
Yep.
He's going to be like, oh, I know this girl on this other Earth that can help us fight the invaders. And he goes and gets her. Like, I think that's going to be that simple. I don't think they're going to spend a long time figuring out. I think they've established that they know each other, that this gate can travel between universes.
So if the Dominators can conquer one Earth, can't they, in theory, conquer all of the Earths?
Assuming the Dominators even exist on whatever universe Supergirl is in. It seems like
Kryptonians
don't exist on Earth 1, so maybe Dominators don't exist on Earth S.
Okay, fair enough. I don't know.
So, we'll see.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting no matter what.
So last week was the conclusion of this season of Vixen.
Yeah.
The six-episode web series of Vixen. So I thought we'd take a few minutes and talk about
the last couple episodes that we watched.
Like our overall thoughts of the whole season. Because even when it was, even in the early episodes this season, we didn't talk about it that much.
I really liked it except for one part of it is that the fire shouldn't have overcome the water element so quickly. I'm kind of bitter. I mean, Yeah, I'll just get to the point. Knocking out Mari's sister who got control of the water totem would have made a lot more sense, like if she was somehow incapacitated. But outright destroying the charm seems impossible to do, like, remotely. Like, it had to have a lot of spirit, and at the end, it was a really high contention point because she had to channel everything that she had in order to crush the amulet, and she could only target the amulet. Like, but the fire-breathing dude was just fighting with all of his strength, but he wasn't doing anything particularly targeted towards the totem itself. In fact, wouldn't it make sense that he wanted to preserve the totem to gain more power for himself? Why was he after the spirit totem but not the water totem? That doesn't make a lot of sense. So that part.
Yeah, but
he
wasn't trying to destroy a totem. He just killed her, and then maybe once he killed Mari, he was going to go back and grab the totem.
No, he destroyed the totem. You saw it flare and disintegrate.
No, Mari destroyed the totem.
No.
Oh, the water? Did he destroy the water totem?
Yeah, he destroyed everything. That's why I'm bothered by it.
I remember that.
There was no totem left behind, and there was no, like. And not only that, but, like, she would have been able to preserve herself because water versus fire is an equalizing force. And so if they were both fighting with everything that they got, I mean, I think she really stood a chance, or, you know, she could have dodged out of the way. It didn't make a lot of sense. It didn't feel right is basically all I say. But the rest of the story really felt right. And once I was like, all right, I'll just, you know, move on from this point. it was enjoyable. And I really, really enjoy the series and the way people were in the story and everything. So it was good.
Yeah. I mean, this season was all about, season one was about getting her to accept her, using her powers and deciding to protect
her destiny,
to take up the lineage and fight for others. Whereas this season was about getting her to accept her broader responsibility as a superhero.
That was really
and
nice
defending
too.
More than just her friends and her people, but defending other cities, other people she'd never met, working with the broader superhero
doing
community.
More.
So I feel like this really sets up retroactively her appearance in her live action appearance in Arrow last season, where she was by then very much a part of the superhero community, and Felicity was able to just call her in and she showed up and helped Oliver and then went away again.
Again,
we talked about how it doesn't really make much sense that the Atom fought alongside her several times here, and yet in Legends of Tomorrow doesn't even recognize the Tantu totem or someone calling themselves Vixen or say, hey, are you the mother or grandmother of the person that I met? Maybe that happened in between scenes or something, but it does seem a little strange that they didn't. It seems like the kind of thing they would want to include, because then that would clue viewers into the fact that there's this other thing that
it would be nice, right?
Like it would give them a path to that. So I'm a little surprised they didn't do that. Maybe we'll see something like that in the crossover, though, because the Vixen that's on Legends of Tomorrow right now, Amaya, is going to be fighting alongside the other superheroes in the crossover.
Yeah.
So maybe Flash or Green Arrow or something will finally comment on the fact that this is a different
Vixen.
I wonder if they're just hoping the viewers don't realize it's a different Vixen, because they think it's kind of confusing that there's two different Vixens, and so they're just kind of pretending that it's like, okay, let's just have the characters treat her as Vixen and not really get into it. The fact that it's a different Vixen on the web series than on the live action stuff.
Wouldn't it kind of make the world explode if there were two Vixens at the same time in the same timeline? Like, why wouldn't they call in Mari too? I don't understand.
The reason why they don't call in Mari for the crossover doesn't make a lot of sense, aside from the fact that maybe she's busy fighting somewhere else. Whereas this Vixen will just show up because the whole team shows up.
Right.
But yeah, it would be kind of cool to have both Vixens fighting side by side.
That would be awesome. That would be so great.
Yeah.
We're totally geeking out on it. But anyway, what did you think of the series just by itself? The animated series now?
I liked it. I mean, I can really see that the animation is being done on a limited budget when you compare it to like the DC animated movies or even other TV stuff like the animation on Young Justice or whatever was surpassed this. Like they're working with very limited budget, you can tell from looking at this. I mean, they've got great voice talent and everything using all the stars from the shows, but I can really tell where the budget is limited. But accepting it for what it is, a little 20-minute story that's being told for online audiences and on the apps and so on, it's good. I mean, it's a good story. I just, it's too bad that it's got such a short runtime and such a limited budget and everything, because I feel like they could really, if they turn it into a lavishly animated, weekly show or even an animated movie once a year or something like that, I feel like they could really go hog wild with it. But it's good. I enjoy it. I wonder if they're going to do more now, or if, again, the fact that they have a different Vixen appearing on TV every week, they're going to feel like, okay, people can get their Vixen fixed now by watching their Vixen, by watching Legends of Tomorrow. And so we don't really need to do any more of the web series. But I do feel like they like working with Megalyn EK, and like they had her, I remember, like during one of the big press tours last year, they had her on stage with Stephen Amell and Grant Gustin. Like she's like one of the pillars of their superhero universe alongside the people that actually have their own live action shows.
Right.
And so I feel like you don't prop her up like that and then never use her again. I just think that she's too busy to commit to a weekly show, but she can come in and record 20 minutes of animation.
I forget. What else is she up to right now?
I have no idea, but apparently that was, she wasn't willing to commit to appear on a weekly show for 3 years or whatever. And so however long the contract for Legends of Tomorrow is. And so they decided, if they're like, okay, we're just going to do a James Bond and cast a different actress that's going to be playing Mari now and not work with her anymore. Like, she's out, this new person's in.
Yeah.
They would have done that if they thought that they wouldn't be able to work with her anymore. Instead, they went through this whole thing of having it be a Vixen from the past so that they can both coexist in the world and they could bring back Megalyn EK if and when they can.
Right.
So I feel like the door is definitely being left open. They could have closed that door a lot more definitively if they wanted to.
Of course.
Recast.
Yeah.
But they didn't, so... So hopefully we'll see her again. It would be kind of cool. It didn't even occur to me to have both Vixens in the crossover. I mean, maybe they will. Maybe they're keeping it a secret, but I've seen nothing to indicate that she'll be in there.
Yeah, we saw the promo shots for, like, on the rooftop scene, like a scene out of it, and you see Adam next to Supergirl next to... Yeah, it's
Supergirl, Green Arrow, Flash, some of the side heroes like Spartan and so
but
on,
I didn't
and
see
all
any
the legends.
Yeah, I saw
and Amaya
just
was
the one
there,
Vixen,
but not Mari,
yeah. But it would make more sense to call her in.
At a certain point, though,
universe-wise.
At a certain point, though, you run up against other restraints. It's not like Justice League Unlimited, where you can have 50 heroes in the background and you just need to pay someone to draw them, and that's it. Like, at a certain point, you're limited by budget, like the number of actors you can pay for a given episode. You know, the number, because you got to pay the actor to be there. Well, there's a reason why TV shows don't have. Most TV shows don't have the same huge cast that movies have, with hundreds of extras in the background and dozens of speaking parts. Most TV shows only have, like, you look at the cast for most TV shows, it's like you have six or seven regulars, usually fewer than 10 named guest stars, and then a few people that get billing at the end, like maybe another 20 people that get billing at the end that didn't even have any lines or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't, it's not like a movie where the cast list scrolls by for 5 minutes. Like, it's completely different, especially when you need to create elaborate costumes for all these people, maintain those costumes, and you need to figure out something to do in the story for that character, so they're not just standing around doing nothing. You know, you want each character to have their own beats and so on. It's like we talked about with, you know, Captain America Civil War, where you don't want to just throw characters in there and not have them do anything. You want each character to have their own few little moments to shine, have kind of an arc over the course of the thing, have their own little story that they're telling, their own issues that they're dealing with. If they'd wanted to, they could have brought in a lot of other characters.
Yeah.
Like, they could have gone way back, and but they could have brought Arsenal over. They could have done, you know, I'm not even sure if, like, that rooftop shot you're talking about, like, Wild Dog isn't there, Ragman isn't
That's
there.
True.
I feel like the Side Arrow characters are going to be kind of sidelined for this one, too, just to focus on the headliners. So I think that you're, like, if you've got, like, 12 superheroes that you're trying to tell a story with, you probably don't want to. And then to have two Vixens in there, like, it'd be cool for the fans. The fans love seeing stuff like that. The fans would have loved to have Jay Garrick in there and, you know, like, everybody.
Sure.
Bring everybody in there. But
it's a party. Everybody's invited.
Bring the Justice Society forward in time and have them help, too. But, you know, it's the kind of thing you can do in a comic where you can have a splash page where there's 200 heroes.
Yeah.
And you just need to pay the artist
Maybe
to
one
draw
day we'll
page,
see that in live action. Because I'll be honest, like, that would be an awesome thing to see in live action.
I feel like you'll see it in the movies. You'll see it in a Marvel movie before you'll see it in the TV shows. Because they can...
Well, we did, right? With Civil War?
Yeah, but even then, that was like 10 or 12 heroes.
Yeah, that was...
We're talking about a shot of like dozens and dozens of heroes.
I understand.
You could do it in a movie, I suppose, if some of them are CG, you know? And then maybe you pay some of the actors to... Like, I don't know. They could figure out a way to do it. But in a TV budget, it's just... It'd be almost impossible to have something that big. But we'll see.
Almost.
We'll see when we next time we record.
Challenge accepted. No,
well, it'll probably be 2 weeks before we have another episode, right? Because we're traveling again next weekend. So when we come back, we'll have the crossover to talk about.
Yep. So are we having a show next week?
I don't see how we can, because we're gonna be away
on the road. On the road again. Okay. Well, yeah. So you guys get a break next week, and we'll be back the week after that, and I will tweet in the meantime. And that actually reminds me, if you want to get in touch with us. Our email address is mailbag@smartspodcast.com. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com. On Twitter, we are @smartspodcast. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/smartspodcast. Yay! How about a funny sound? He's shaking his head. No. It's not a loud enough shake. Oh, no, he's giving me puppy dog eyes. All right, how about this? Do, 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 do. Ha ha.